Welcome back to the A is for Apple podcast, an encyclopedia of food and drink with me, Sam Bilton, Neil Buttery and Ali Pino. We'll be taking a deep dive into food and drink culture letter by letter, and this season we're exploring the letter A. How are you both doing today?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, not bad.
I'm fine, thank you, Sam.
Jolly good. Well, I'm in the driving seat today, and we are going to be immersing ourselves in the wonderfully fragrant arena of aromatics, which has taken us all over the world. Well, metaphorically speaking. So what have you got for me today? Which one of you is going to go first?
Shall I go first, Neil? Aniseed? Do you want to know a bit about aniseed?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed researching for this, and I found out some really special facts, which you're about to hear.
A is for aniseed. Aniseed, scientifically known as Pimpinella anisum, hails from the eastern Mediterranean region and southwest Asia, and is the botanical cousin to herbs like parsley, dill, and fennel. It is a herbaceous annual plant that grows up to 90 centimeters or more. The leaves at the base of the plant are simple and shallowly lobed. Higher leaves on the stem are feathery and divided into small leaflets. The flowers are either white or yellow. The flavour and aroma of aniseed is similar to other spices and herbs such as star anise, fennel, licorice and tarragon. It is commonly cultivated and used to flavour food, sweets and alcoholic beverages, particularly around the Mediterranean. The name aniseed is derived from the old French and Latin word anisum, or Greek anisum, referring to the herb dill. In Western cuisine, aniseed is used to flavour dishes, drinks, and sweets. The word aniseed is used for both species of herb and its licorice flavour. Journeying back in time, we find aniseed deeply embedded in the kitchens of ancient Greece and Rome. These cultures revered aniseed for its perceived digestive benefits, even using it as a spice in their cake recipes, a tradition that lingers in some regional sweets to this day. But aniseed didn't confine itself to the Mediterranean. It embarked on a global adventure, lending its unique taste to a plethora of dishes. In European cuisines, it found a place in an array of baked goods, from cookies to bread, while in Asia it became an essential spice in curries and stews. Beyond its culinary charm, aniseed was known for its medicinal applications, thought to aid digestion and alleviate gastrointestinal discomfort. It was even used to mask the taste of less palatable medicines. The main use of aniseed in traditional European herbal medicine is for reducing flatulence. Now, the seed was noted as an aid to reduce belching and calming the stomach. According to Pliny the Elder, aniseed was also used to aid with sleep and freshen breath. He also claimed that mixing it with wine was a remedy for asp bites. And let's not forget its aromatic qualities in the realm of spirits. Aniseed plays a vital role in the creation of famous liquors such as the iconic aperitif absinthe, which Neil told us all about on a previous episode of A is for Apple. Now, imagine you're living in the early 1600s and you have failed to digest your lunch. No bother, just wait for an aniseed water peddler to come by your abode and you'll be fighting fit in no time. That's right, aniseed water. The earliest known use of this concoction is in the early 1600s. Now, aniseed water Robin was a 17th century London character who became legendary. He earned his unusual name due to his occupation as a peddler of aniseed water, a carminative to soothe digestive discomfort. Aniseed water Robin even has his own tune. The music was originally published by John Playford in the first edition of his English Dancing Master, 1651, and here's a snippet. But now it's time to focus on aniseed balls. Why the balls, I hear you ask? Well, why not? In 2009, aniseed balls were voted Britain's favourite childhood sweets. Aniseed balls are a comfit type of hard, round sweet. They are shiny and dark and reddish brown and hard, like gobstoppers, but generally only about a centimetre big. They are flavoured by aniseed oil with a strong aniseed flavour and last for a long time in the mouth before dissolving. In the centre of the ball is normally a whole rapeseed, which is used for forming layers of sugar around, although sometimes sugar crystals are used. Now, fascinatingly, aniseed balls were actually used during the Second World War as a timing device, and I'm about to explain how. So in the spring of 1939, a magnetically attached limpet mine was constructed in Britain for underwater sabotage actions in the upcoming war. The mines exploded when a cocked spring hit a detonator. Now, between the striker and the detonator, an aniseed ball was placed, as each ball had precisely the same spherical shape and consistently dissolved in water after 35 minutes, leaving the saboteur time to escape. So the first of these mines was sent to Yugoslavia and Egypt in the autumn of 1939. So these ingenious devices exploded when a cocked spring hit a detonator, and an aniseed ball acted as a timer, providing saboteurs with a safe window to escape. A most unexpected application for a sweet treat. So, next time you come across aniseed balls, remember that they're not just nostalgic sweets, but bear witness to an intriguing slice of history. And that wraps up my exploration of A is for aniseed. This versatile ingredient has left an indelible mark on culinary traditions and historical intrigue.
That was really interesting. I know I read something the other day about Roman weddings and that they used to serve cakes flavoured with aniseed, because apparently when aniseed was mixed with honey, it was said to have aphrodisiac qualities.
Yes, that's right. It does. And still today in the south of Italy, you will find quite a lot of biscuits and cakes made with aniseed, especially where I'm from in the south. And they're quite versatile because you can have them with milk, say in the morning, but also at the end of your day, you can dip them into wine as a digestive.
I like the fact that people think of it as a digestive and an aphrodisiac, and that it's a good idea to serve it at the end of a meal at a wedding because you're covering both bases.
I also discovered that it was good for flatulence as well. So yeah, you really are covering all the bases, aren't you?
And notwithstanding this, it's not really a particularly popular kind of taste. Do you think it's because it's quite strong? I don't know what it is. Whenever I think of aniseed, and actually my grandmother used to always give me aniseed sweets and no one wanted them apart from me. I love them. Everyone else used to choose the honey ones or mint ones, but I like them. And I always thought to myself, it's a particular taste that not everyone is prone to like.
Yeah, I think it must be a love or hate thing. It's a bit medicinal, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Is that what they put in gripe water for babies?
Ooh. Oh, you've touched on a very interesting topic here, because there was something that was called all fours, and it was something that did used to be given to children, because for working mothers at the time of factory days, when they would have to leave their children for long hours during the day, they would feed them this medicinal concoction, which included aniseed, because it is a very strong element that induces sleep. In too much high quantities, it's actually very damaging.
You're sure it wasn't mixed with something like opium?
And laudanum, yes.
Or laudanum, yeah.
It was.
Like a precursor to Medicaid.
Exactly. So that's why it was all fours, the four ingredients. And this included opium, yeah, laudanum and aniseed. I mean, aniseed principally, it did obviously have an effect, but it was also to cover the taste, I think, of the other things because of that strong taste.
Cough candy, that's aniseed flavoured, isn't it? Or I got that mixed up with
cough
a different flavour.
Cough candy. No, I remember cough candy.
Is this pre-Fisherman's Friend then? Because that's what I grew up with. Do you remember Fisherman's Friend?
Yeah, I remember Fisherman's Friend, but I didn't go anywhere.
We've all sucked on a Fisherman Friend in our time, I'm sure.
I certainly have.
Well, moving on. So cough candy. Yeah, it's like a boiled sweet. But I think my memory is that it has sort of an aniseed flavour. But
yeah, I can't remember. I remember having it, buying it from the sweet shop.
And that and aniseed balls, which I had a love-hate relationship, is one of those things. I think I didn't want to miss out on the sweets, so I would eat them, but I wasn't really that keen on the flavour.
So. You don't see aniseed balls anymore, do you? I used to like them, though. Tell you what, one thing that you mentioned there, and I don't know why this had never occurred to me, but when you're sucking on your aniseed ball and you get to the seed in the middle, I always assumed it was an aniseed.
Yeah, is it not?
No.
Surprise, surprise.
Grape seed. And then I thought, oh, of course it isn't, because if you, aniseed quite commonly grows on hedgerows. It's hard to tell the difference between them all. Some of them are giant hogweed or something. You can just pinch the seed in half and give it a sniff and you can tell which ones are aniseed, and they're really big and flat. So there's no way that can become an aniseed ball. But I just never put the two together.
Weird. I always assumed it was an aniseed.
Because, you know, all the other things like cumin or caraway comfits are made by rolling the little seed.
Yeah.
You see it, don't you, on sort of historical cooking demonstrations, that big copper pan over the heat, and they're rolling around the seeds with their bare hands and slowly building up layers and layers and layers of sugar. And you've got that really aromatic seed in the middle that's emanating its spices throughout the whole thing. So I assumed that's what was happening with the aniseed. It was just giving out its aroma as you added layer and layer and layer. But it's just aniseed-flavoured sugar that they're just adding to it, I guess.
That's right, yes. It's normally either crystallised sugar in the middle or a rapeseed. So a little bit deceptive.
Have you ever seen a dog eat an aniseed ball?
No.
I have heard of this. I have heard of this, but not. I know it's like the equivalent of catnip, but for dogs.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Apparently, if you want to take a holistic approach to your dog's health and help your dog with digestive issues such as nausea or gas, just like with humans, then you can use aniseed balls, but a little bit of aniseed is sprinkled inside the treats, not a whole ball. And this reminded me of those, you know, you ever seen those true crime stories set in Italy, you know, with mafia or camorra, 'ndrangheta, and the dog always dies. And normally they fed them an aniseed ball and
right.
The dog dies because a couple of days later, they intend to rob the house or kidnap someone or do something, but the dog has to go first. And so then that's always an indication.
So they dip it in a bit of cyanide before they pop it through the letterbox. Is that what's going on?
Well, it's actually aniseed. If you give dog too much aniseed, it has the same effect.
Right. So it's I suppose it happens to us when we take any drug like alcohol. You have too much, you're going to make yourself ill.
That's what we said with absinthe, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
So do you think it's more of a spice that's used on the continent rather than in Britain? Over here, it seems, aniseed balls aside, which we've just discovered that they don't actually contain aniseeds at all. Do you think it's more common in culinary recipes on the continent, whereas over here it seems to be more medicinal, as I said, like bright water and cordials?
Yeah.
And
well, if you think that the English kind of used it during the war alongside mines and for minotaur purposes, yes, definitely not so much in the cooking. It has that combination of, I would say, it can be used in sweet and savoury dishes, but it's a lot more frequent outside, yes, on the continent for sure.
I'm just thinking, really, most people, I mean, I'm projecting here. It's my own experiences, really, and applying them to everyone else. But I would say the times when I've experienced aniseed is student days. Too much drinking, mid-90s, and ouzo.
Yes.
Holy cow.
Oh. Yeah.
It's got that fresh taste to it that makes you feel like, you know, it's not an unpleasant taste. You know, when you have too many Jaeger bombs or things with stuff like Red Bull and stuff, it doesn't have that fresh kind of minty taste. And I feel like aniseed has that.
Yeah, but of course, being stupid binge drink Britain, what we tend to do is go, oh brilliant, let's have some ouzo, and not realize that you're meant to water it down like absinthe or like pastis. You know, it's watered down. We don't do that, idiots.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a student, we had a really good house party and I woke up very hungover and I rolled over, saw my bedside table, and I thought to myself how excellent I was, bearing in mind what state I was in, to bring myself a nice big mug of water with me. So I rolled over, took a great big gulp, and it was neat ouzo.
Great.
And I had to spend the rest of the morning shaking in clammy sweat in the back garden in my underpants.
And that is an experience that I think most people have had at some point, where you misinterpret a drink for something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be worse.
And it's definitely the gift that keeps giving. That's what I used to find with anything sort of aniseed flavoured. The next day, it just keeps coming back. It's, it's not good.
Yeah, so we've misused it.
You know, in ancient Rome, aniseed was used quite a bit, even in savoury dishes. There's one soup called La Zuppa di Varrone, which has aniseed in, and it plays quite a strong role. And the thing I think with aniseed is that it can be a bit overpowering, which is perhaps the reason behind it not being used in some cuisines, which are perhaps a little bit blander or don't have other strong ingredients within them.
Yeah, it's funny. And you can also grow it in Britain. So you'd think it'd be a bit like, I don't know, mustard and caraway. I mean, caraway's not that popular in Britain now, but it used to be because you could grow it at least in our end of Europe, maybe not Britain. So you'd think aniseed would be part of the culture, or maybe it had once been part of the culture, but it's just not there, is it, really?
No, it's not. No. And I have a bone to pick, because when I was doing my research, obviously I always love looking at the literary side of references, and in quite a few places on the internet, I'm talking about research that wasn't in other books or no encyclopedias or anything like that, but they do mention there being aniseed in The Hobbit, and it's repeated really often. And I think it's just because people are not looking at the original text. When you read the original text, it does mention seed cakes, but there's no reference to aniseed. And I wonder where this misinterpretation came about. And I started thinking, well, maybe a seed cake could be aniseed. But then, as the writer of The British Food, A History writes, seed cake cannot be made with any other seed than caraway.
Correct.
In the sense that you could swap them for poppy seeds, but that is a cake with seeds in and not a seed cake. Correct. I think, I don't know if you know the author of that.
Did I write that?
Yeah, you did.
Well, it's true.
I was looking online. And of course, I found what Arneil had written. Do you stand by that? So that's,
I do.
So where did that aniseed come from in reinterpreting that text? I do wonder.
Normally, Neil, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but when you make a seed cake, there's a lot of caraway seeds in it generally. I think you have to be fairly generous.
Yeah, you have to hold back for modern tastes, I would say.
But if you put that, say you put a tablespoon of aniseed into a seed cake, that's going to taste quite rank, I think. But then I'm not a big lover of aniseed.
Yeah, it'd be like you're eating one of those urine tablets that you find in men's loose.
Can't say I've ever tried that. I'm not planning to either. But then, I know on the subject of seed cakes, I know you do sometimes see coriander seeds used in cakes quite extensively as an alternative to caraway, but I have never seen aniseed as a standalone ingredient suggested as an ingredient for a seed cake.
No. Yeah, maybe someone listening knows, and I don't know. I'm just very, very curious to see where that came about, you know, that leading to this aniseed, where it just says seed cake, and obviously caraway seeds being the only seeds used in a seed cake normally.
So the great cake that's in Gervase Markham's The Good Housewife, that's got aniseeds in it, but it's not a seed cake. It's got aniseeds in the spice mix.
Oh, okay.
So it was definitely used in cooking, but not to the extent where you'd go, that's an aniseed cake. I mean, can you imagine what the dogs would do if they got hold of an aniseed cake?
Oh, yeah. You know, when you go to a grocery store and you buy some spices, and there's really good Asian sort of cash and carry just down the road from me, and they've got loads of spices. It's fab. I'm not sure if I've ever seen aniseeds. You see star anise. Is that the same thing?
No, it's not the same thing.
It's a different thing. Okay.
Yes, it's a different thing. And it's much more common now.
Yeah. But we don't see aniseeds at all, ground or whole or anything, do we?
No.
We just see them extracted in alcohol and things.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not an easy spice to get hold of in this country, I don't think. Yeah. Not compared to other spices.
It was really interesting to research this.
Okay, Sam, you're up next. What have you got for us?
So I'm going to look at a spice that I think it's overlooked, even though it is quite widely used in the British kitchen. And it's one of those things that we don't tend to think of when we talk about the Columbian Exchange, although until Columbus set sail, as we shall find out shortly, searching for the Indies, we didn't know of this spice. And that is, of course, allspice or pimento.
Yes, a forgotten New World food, isn't it? One that we've forgotten has came in with potatoes and chilies and tomatoes and things like that. Yeah. Yeah, I use a lot in my cooking. So this is going to be interesting.
We actually used allspice recently in our whole poached chicken recipe for a Gothic cookbook.
Sounds delicious.
A is for allspice. When Columbus set sail from Spain in 1492, he was looking for a new route to the Spice Islands. Taking a westerly route rather than heading eastwards around Africa, he eventually found the Bahamas, which he assumed to be the Indies. He was also convinced that on these islands he had found pepper, when in fact he had discovered nothing of the sort. There is some question over whether Columbus himself encountered the small, hard brown berries that we now know as allspice, but we do know that the Spanish were the first to call them pimento or Jamaican pepper, after the island on which it was first discovered. Although allspice actually grows across Central America, the berries were given their name because their aroma is said to resemble that of nutmeg, cinnamon, and cloves, hence allspice. In 1655, the British took control of Jamaica from the Spanish and therefore gained access to large quantities of allspice. Allspice was relatively cheap compared to Old World spices. In 1694, you could buy half a pound or 225 grams of allspice for a shilling, but you could only get 2 ounces or 55 grams of nutmegs for the same price. It was grown alongside the more lucrative crops of sugar, tobacco, and cotton, although it also grew freely in the wild. As with these other commodities, allspice was harvested by slaves. I had a chat with food writer Melissa Thompson to find out more about Jamaica's popular jerk seasoning, which includes allspice as one of its components. Melissa's first book, Motherland, explores Jamaica's culinary history and has quite a bit to say on the subject of jerk.
Can you explain exactly what jerk is?
Yeah, so jerk is a dish, but it's also the preparation. So it's kind of a noun, but then also a verb as well. So to jerk something is, I guess, now is most commonly known in its chicken form, like jerk chicken, I think, because chicken is the most widely consumed protein. It kind of makes sense. Traditionally, it was pork. Now you can jerk chicken, goat, lamb, seafood. You can get jerk lobster. The principal ingredient in jerk is allspice. And traditionally, the wood was also used. So you get the protein and you marinate it in kind of a combination of different things. And there are some variations, but typically kind of the most important ingredients are your pimento berries, allspice berries, garlic, ginger, thyme, scotch bonnet, and then typically like a bit of vinegar and some sugar and some salt, black pepper, spring onion, maybe regular onions. And then you marinate your protein and then you cook it over fire, but you don't want an intense heat. You want to kind of, it's almost like steaming it over the heat. So if you go to Jamaica, but if you go to a proper jerk pit, you'll have pimento wood and it's almost like a raft. And then the protein sits on top of that. And then you have a covering. It could be more wood. It could be some sort of corrugated zinc. And then the fire is quite far down below that. So maybe like a sort of a meter and a half. The wood is kind of offering a protection and kind of giving off its moisture, but also imparting it with flavor. And so that is what jerk is. Here, I use pimento berries when I'm cooking it because it's not very sustainable to get pimento wood. So I soak the pimento berries as well as having it in the marinade and then use maybe like a light wood, a soft wood, like apple wood, and then throw that onto the fire. And I also smoke it on a bed of bay leaves and bay branches. And then the combination of the pimento berries and the bay branches and bay leaves really replicates that flavor of allspice. So it's the dish of jerk, but then the preparation of it is very important. And Tan Sloan, he wrote about it, his natural history book came out, I think, in 1705. And in it, he spoke about a preparation of wild pigs being captured by people. So the history of it is Maroons, who were people who had been enslaved, Africans who had been enslaved, who escaped and were living in the mountainous regions of Jamaica. And with the remaining Taino, the indigenous Jamaicans, they were very good at cooking over fire, and they kind of, between them, kind of had this way of cooking underground, using pimento, but also using leaves and wrapping the protein in leaves so it wouldn't give too much smoke away, because the British were trying to recapture the Maroons and they didn't want to give their position away. Hans Sloan, who wrote about it, he said how the pork is kind of lanced with sort of a knife through to kind of really get the seasoning. And the seasoning was so as much for preservation as it was for flavor. Because no one really knows where the name jerk comes from. There's different ideas, different beliefs. One of them is this process of kind of stabbing the protein. And he says, and that's called jerking the meat.
So why does jerk engender such a sense of national identity in Jamaica?
I think jerk is so important in Jamaica because it's really delicious, ultimately. It's so tasty. And I think because it's kind of, it takes a certain skill to make it, I think. You know, I've been cooking jerk for a long time and I'm still learning. But also, I mean, it's a resistance dish, ultimately. It's born out of quite horrendous conditions. I think, you know, with a lot of Jamaican foods, a lot of food of like the American South that was kind of rooted in enslavement, some of these dishes just made the most out of really poor quality ingredients or ingredients that weren't really favoured because they were tougher to cook. You know, it's kind of an alchemy where you have these dishes that are kind of maybe using cuts of meat that are rejected by other people. And then through time and through love and through skill, it's so unique to Jamaica. I mean, you can get jerk across other Caribbean islands, but it's very much a Jamaican dish. And it's now known throughout the world. You know, you have jerk masters and you have the jerk pits. And if you go there in Jamaica, they are really well attended. They're just busy, they're hot, and you can just watch everything being cooked, and you know, you have to wait for it to be ready. I think that sense of anticipation really feeds into it as well. It's just a really special dish, and I think it says so much about Jamaican history, the resilience of the Jamaican people, and just the absolute culinary skill of the Jamaican people.
And how is it involved in Britain, for better or worse?
You can get some really amazing jerk in Britain. Now we can get sort of pretty much every ingredient apart from pimento woods. And that's fine because food's always evolving. So I think it's quite special that there are other ways to cook something in a place other than its point of origin, using what is local to you and what is available. I think that's quite a beautiful evolution of a dish, really. There have been misuses of the word jerk. And I think this goes back to its popularity. And any popular dish becomes a buzzword, right? And then that buzzword becomes a shortcut that people use it to kind of cover all manners of dishes that maybe aren't really anything to do with the original or kind of a bit of a lazy ripoff. And you go to most supermarkets, they will have something that has jerk on the label. And then you have, you know, like jerk paste and things like that, which I think are quite handy for people. And I think it's good to get it out there. The skill isn't in the making of the seasoning or the sauce. The skill is in how you cook it. And so I think while we can get really good jerk in this country, if someone does a poor rendition, or someone kind of takes the mickey with it, or someone who's not connected to the culture comes up with a jerk dish that is so far removed from the original, then there is going to be an outcry. So I think it's really important that we always respect the origins of food and you know, give credit and also give back to the culture, because it's, you know, I think it's all Jamaican food, food from the Caribbean, food from across Africa, like lots of things with those two regions. Traditionally, the West is just taken from those places and not really given anything back. And it's not, I think people think that people are just waiting to have a go at anyone who isn't from the culture and have a pop at them for cooking it because they're not related to it. But actually, if you go on social media, like if you go on sort of Instagram and you look at some people cooking Jamaican food, when they do it well, the Jamaicans love it. They're like, look at this guy. Like, it's not, like, you know, keep watching. It's not going to be as bad as you think. He does it really well. And that's always a really celebration.
That was very interesting. Do you know what? I didn't realize that allspice was even one of the spices included in a jerk seasoning. Though it makes perfect sense, of course, because it goes by the name in some books, older books, as Jamaica pepper, doesn't it? So it's kind of obvious, really.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's actually the trees themselves, although they take a long time to reach maturity, once they get there, apparently they produce fruit for 100 years or so. I mean, they're quite phenomenal in that respect. And they use the wood to make walking sticks.
So when did we start to use allspice in British cooking?
Well, we got hold of Jamaica. Well, I say we got hold of it. We took it from the Spanish, who'd obviously taken it from the indigenous people that lived there before they arrived, in 1655. So we start to see it appearing sort of from the late 17th century into sort of the 18th century. I mean, it was called allspice because of its wonderful aroma it has, and it supposedly mimics cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves. Personally, I think it's closer to cloves. That's my take on it.
Yeah.
But I guess everyone's different.
People do get it confused with mixed spice.
They do, don't they? Yeah, particularly when
it's
round. Which
makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, you'd think, oh, okay, that's a mixed spice if it's called allspice. So it's a bit misleading or a bit confusing sometimes.
I think Elizabeth David says you can basically use allspice instead of cloves at a pinch.
Okay. I mean, I know that in Yorkshire, it used to, anyway, go by the name of clove pepper.
Yes, Jane Grigson has a recipe, doesn't she, for Yorkshire curd tarts.
Yes.
I've never heard of that. Clove pepper. Okay.
I've eaten a lot of curd tarts in my time. They're still quite popular in Yorkshire, especially in York. And as far as I'm concerned, it's the only spice that should go in a Yorkshire curd tart. And it's usually a spice that we have in savoury foods, if at all. And I remember thinking, this doesn't sound right, when I made my very first one. And instantly, you know, it was like, oh, this is essence of Yorkshire curd tart. It's so odd, isn't it, how a spice can taste so different if it's cooked with savoury food compared to sweet food.
Yeah, I mean, I quite like it in sweet food. I use it quite a bit when I wrote my gingerbread book. You'll probably also know, Neil, that it's used in pepper cake, which apparently is why Yorkshire pepper cake is called pepper cake, because it has Jamaica pepper in it. So
that's right. No black pepper in it.
No,
the weird one.
But yeah, it's certainly used in gingerbreads, especially when you get to sort of the late 18th, early 19th century. And I guess because it was so much cheaper, if you think about it, it's produced in prolific quantities, and it could be used in theory to replace those really expensive spices, nutmeg and cinnamon and cloves.
And that's why it was probably taken up so readily in Yorkshire, with it being a bit cheaper, because we're famously known for our tight home economics.
Only you can say that, Neil.
I'm allowed to say it, can't I?
You're allowed to say it.
It'd be racist if either of you two said it. But yeah, we're famously tight-fisted. So it's not a surprise that maybe the cheapest spice was used. But very quickly, these things become traditional and just tied together. And now you can't add anything else in. They're really good Yorkshire curd tarts. You have to make your own curd cheese. There's no way of buying.
I was about to ask you that, because I know Jane Grigson says it can't be cottage cheese or cream cheese.
Yeah, it was a disaster otherwise. You sometimes see those Canadian cheese curds in shops these days, but they're too rubbery. Now, you have to make your own with a little bit of... You can buy some vegetable rennet, or maybe just squeeze some lemon juice in and just pass it through a cheesecloth overnight and then use that. When you look at old recipes in the 17th, 18th centuries for cheesecakes, these are the cheesecakes that they're talking about. They were eaten all across the country. They just seem to have hung on in York for some reason.
It's baked in a case, obviously. If it's
baked in a case, mixed with eggs and sugar and a little bit of butter and clove pepper and the curds. It's really nice, very easy to make. It's not a type of custard tart. Some people think, you sort of suspend the curd cheese in a custard. But it's not. You just add the eggs to it. Some people think you add cinnamon to it. Paul Hollywood, I'm looking at you.
Staring daggers, I think.
No cinnamon. Yes. I saw on a programme years ago. I was livid. He said it's a kind of custard tart flavoured with cinnamon. And I flipped.
Did you write in? You know how one used to write in and say...
Yeah. Why, BBC? But they're worth making. There's a recipe on my blog, but I'll put it on the Substack for people to have a go if they want.
That'd be good. I think it's more commonly associated with savoury cooking, so pickles in particular. I don't think you could buy a pickling spice if you go to a shop and you buy pickling spice. It wouldn't have allspice in there.
Yeah, but it used to be. And it's certainly used in combination with juniper berries, black peppercorns, when curing meat. There's a really good spiced beef recipe that... I got via Elizabeth David. She wrote a good pamphlet on meats, cooking meats and curing meats and things. It's in an omelette and a glass of wine.
Oh, okay.
And it's one of her, and I'm going to be controversial now, it's one of the few recipes that work written by Elizabeth David.
You said it. You can't take it.
You said it. Yeah, you said it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great. I used to cook it all the time. It used to be sold in Harrods at Christmas. And you can cook it. It's just brisket. You cure it with some sugar and some salt, cook it down in the oven. And any leftovers, you can mix up with butter and make a nice sort of potted beef spread.
Right, yeah.
Really good.
Does she use saltpeter as well to keep the meat looking nice and pink?
Yeah, so I've done that. I've done the old recipes using saltpeter. And maybe we should maybe save saltpeter or nitrates for series N and series S. Yeah. But there's a lot of issues, isn't there, about having nitrates in your food.
Yes.
And it being bad for you. But I mean, I've looked at the science behind it, and they are correlated, but correlation isn't causation.
No.
And I've got a feeling there's something else going on than nitrates being to blame.
There are probably much worse things to have in food nowadays anyway, I would say.
Mm. And it's just to make it pink. It's not doing any... There's a lot of stuff around it. It's meant to be particularly effective against botulism and things like that, but it's not. It's just purely to keep it nice and pink looking.
Well, interestingly, the allspice is actually supposed to have antibacterial properties, and they're supposed to be good, or antimicrobial properties. It's supposed to be good to protect against salmonella and listeria, I believe. Although I would add that if you have chicken that you think is dodgy, no amount of allspice is going to help you. Salmonella if it's undercooked. Yeah. So just so we're clear.
I was just going to ask you, Sam, what the health benefits of allspice were. And you know how we said that aniseed served the kind of function of aphrodisiac, but also digestive. Does allspice have that in any way, like different functions?
Well, interesting you should mention that. Apparently the Mayans used to use it as an embalming spice. But the weirdest thing I came across was actually from someone writing in 1971. I'd have to look up the name of the author and put it in the show notes. But he claimed that it could be used as an alternative we're in the aphrodisiac realms here, to chilies. Yes, an alternative to chilies mixed with pepper placed on the penis before intercourse.
Ooh.
Again, I'm not advocating anyone try that. I think the author was perhaps barking up the wrong tree, or quite sadistic, one or the other. Yeah.
Isn't it odd that we've only talked about five different things beginning with A, and the two main themes is everything is an aphrodisiac, everything is to prevent some kind of diarrhea.
Yep.
So far.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah, exactly.
Because what goes in must come out, but how? In what way?
Well,
let's, you know, discuss the modalities of that.
Yes, indeed.
I think it was also good for it as a breath freshener, which is perhaps a nice way to think of it as a spice. Ali, was it used much in Italy at all?
Not that I know of. Not that much. To be honest, I don't know.
I'm sure someone listening might know, though. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just not a thing.
Or Spanish cooking even, because obviously the Spanish were in Jamaica before us.
Yes,
so you'd think perhaps it would be used in Spanish cooking, but I don't know enough of anyone listening that knows the answer to that. Maybe it is still used in Spanish cooking. Maybe there's a Spanish curd tart out there that uses clove pepper. We don't know of it.
That'd be good.
That would be really good to know. In Italian cooking, I can't, perhaps more in Mexican. No, Italian, it doesn't come to mind at the moment, but I don't think it's something that certainly from where my family is from is something that we'd use, no.
So it seems that it might have come as far as England or Britain and stopped. Although actually, no, I think now I say that, I think maybe in Scandinavia they use it in their pickles.
So now we're going to hear all about asafoetida from Neil.
Yeah, asafoetida, or as it turns out, it's asafoetida. I've been pronouncing it wrong my whole life.
Well, me too.
Because it's a relatively new spice to me, but you know what I mean. Yeah, it's asafoetida. It's something relatively new to me. When I got into cooking as a hobby back in the very early 2000s. I wasn't particularly interested in British food or historical cooking. It was all about Italian food and Asian, especially Indian food. And none of the cookbooks I had in there even mentioned asafoetida at all. And now, if you buy a cookery book, Indian cookery book, it's a fairly common spice used in there. It's pretty much everywhere and it's fairly easy to get hold of. And I'm really glad that I discovered it, because in some religions and groups of people who don't eat onion or garlic, it's a replacement because of its sort of sulfurous odour. And I have, it's going to be more digestive talk, I'm afraid, but I have IBS. And one of the things that I can't eat is onions. And it's a real P in the A, let me tell you, because every recipe starts with first chop an onion, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's great that I've discovered that you can add a pinch of asafoetida or asafoetida to something and you suddenly get a kind of a oniony waft. So it's been a lifesaver. So when you mentioned aromatics, Sam, as an episode, I immediately knew what I was going to do.
A is for asafoetida. Asafoetida stinks. There's a clue that it does in its name. The fetida part speaks for itself, really. It has a very fetid odour. The asa part means resin, but I'll get onto that. It's perhaps best known for its pungency. Recipes usually ask for just a pinch of the stuff to flavour curries and dals, at least in my experience. And it even crops up in Samuel Johnson's dictionary. He defines it thus: asafoetida, a gum or resin brought from the East Indies, of a sharp taste and a strong offensive smell. It goes by several other names like devil's dung, Meurtre de Diable, and stinking gum. In India, it's called Hing, and it's by this name it was commonly called in English manuscripts in the 16th and 17th centuries, but these are confined to medical texts and books. But it does show that it was via India that it came to early modern Britain. But what is it? Well, it is a resin that's extracted from a plant called Ferula asafoetida, and it's part of the very large Apiaceae family, which used to be called the Umbilifers, more commonly called the carrot family, which includes carrots, coriander, parsley, celery, dill, aniseed, and many other things, including nasty plants like giant hogweed and hemlock water dropwort. It grows in an arc on the eastern side of the Mediterranean Sea to South Asia and is native to West and Central Asia, especially Iran and Afghanistan. The plants are grown until their carrot-like taproots are huge, about 15 centimetres in diameter, which takes a good 4 or 5 years. The root is cut at its widest point, just below the stalk, and a milky juice is exuded with a very strong fetid odour. This is best done before flowering time, so there's the maximum amount of nutrients in the root, and therefore the Asafoetida spice will be of a superior quality. The milky juice is then allowed to dry into a gummy resin. The root quickly heals up, so extra slices are taken from the root to get more juice. The best quality Asafoetida comes in the resinous form, sometimes called tears, but it's the powder that's most commonly seen in Europe. Well, I've done some digging and I've found the earliest use of the spice that's known anyway goes right back to 750 BCE with the Babylonians. Not much later, the Persians take it up and use it in the preparation of meat because it acts as a very good meat tenderizer. The Macedonians used it in the 5th century BCE, probably picking it up from their Persian conquests. It was used by Alexander the Great's men, who apparently liked to eat raw meat, and the Asafoetida helped with the digestion of it. The ancient Greeks and Romans knew of it. Aristotle mentions Asafoetida in his book on midwifery as a way to cure a wandering womb. It is believed that the womb physically moved around the female body, causing a range of maladies, and Asafoetida was used to get a wandering womb back to where it should be. Other stinking herbs could be used too. Apparently the womb was attracted to the pungent smell, so you smeared it on the feet if the womb was too high in the body, or onto the head if it was too low. But most importantly, it was used as a substitute for another plant called silphium, a plant much prized. It's closely related to the ferula species, and it seemed to do everything. It was a perfume, seasoning, condiment, medicine, vegetable, preservative, and an aphrodisiac, but isn't everything. Now, silphium wasn't common, and it doesn't seem to have been grown as a crop, and it actually went extinct somewhere around the 5th century, and Asafoetida was the closest thing to it in aroma. In fact, before it went extinct, Asafoetida was used as an adulterant to make the silphium go that little bit further. History isn't sure when Asafoetida came to India, but it was a common spice when the Portuguese colonists came in the 16th century. The vast majority of Asafoetida is consumed in that country today. It's prized for its powerful anti-flatulence properties and is therefore used alongside famously windy vegetables like beans and lentils. It's used instead of garlic and onions for many Hindus and for Jains too. This is because Asafoetida has quite an oniony odour, and that's due to the high proportion of sulphurous compounds contained within the resin. As for the UK, well, it's never been used extensively as a spice. Medicine, yes, food, no, and only in the last couple of decades has it become more commonly seen, thanks to a now very well established and integrated Indian population. But there is one exception. It is rumoured that Asafoetida is one of the secret ingredients in Leon Perrin's Worcester sauce.
So what I wanted to ask, and you mentioned about how it can be used to replace, or the sulphurous kind of smell replace is similar to garlic or, and you know, I read that Asafoetida sometimes can be worn round people's necks to ward off infection and disease. And it really reminded me of how you would wear maybe garlic or garlic really reminded me of that. I just made the connection.
Is that just a coincidence? That sounds like there could be a connection there.
Yeah, maybe they're Indian vampires. Mm.
Is it just stinky? Yeah.
Or just stinky things keep away bad spirits?
Yeah. I think you're not attracting something, you know, you're attracting what's, if you're really into something, then you'll get close. Otherwise, if you're not that serious, go away.
That's interesting. I didn't come across that. That's good.
The dried gum of it. So can it be turned into a dried gum? Apparently that's what's worn around.
That's how it's obtained as a dry gum and then usually it's ground down.
Right. Okay.
Into a powder. And that's how we usually get it over here. I need to try and get hold of the resin. You know, when you buy a ground spice and you it loses its pungency. Yeah. I wonder if you get the same thing with asafoetida.
Yes.
If you sort of grate a little bit, you know, into your food, do you get this really strong smell, which I don't find offensive. I remember.
Do you think it's that bad? Do you think it's that bad?
Because John O'Connell said in his book of spices that it smells like pickled eggs covered in manure, which I thought was a little harsh because I have used it in the past in Indian cooking, but I don't remember it smelling that bad.
It certainly has a strong smell. And when you buy some, like a fresh bag of it, I have my little spice pots that I arrange alphabetically, of course I do. And I put my asafoetida in there and the whole kitchen and lounge smells of it. But it's not an unpleasant smell, I don't think at all. I wonder if it's a bit like something like coriander or grapefruit pith, you know, where you some people just react quite violently disgusted to it and other people think it's fine. So I wonder if it's something to do with that, maybe. I think it's pretty inoffensive. Yeah, and recipes say, don't they, like add a tiny pinch at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, but recipes always say, they say that. I go
straight in with at least a quarter of a teaspoon of it.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing if you're using it as a replacement for onions and garlic, then you kind of need to use more than a pinch, wouldn't you, to have any effect on the dish?
That's true. But a little bit of asafoetida and some leek, because I'm all right with leeks. Don't ask me why.
Yep.
Can't do onions, can't do garlic, but I can do leek. So a bit of leek and some asafoetida, and you've pretty much got pretty oniony flavour. I say that as somebody who doesn't eat onions anymore. I guess it's a bit like when people say, oh, I've got this mock meat and it's just like the real thing. And then you eat it and you're like, no, it's not.
Well, if it's for a health issue, right? That's completely understandable that you'd have to use an alternative. So why don't the Hindus and Jains eat onions and garlic? I didn't know that.
That's right. So that's why it's so common in spices. Well, so first of all, it crops up because it's a digestive aid to you. So it's always put in curries that contain windy things. So things with brassicas, things with beans and peas and pulses. But some groups of Hindus do not eat onions or garlic. Now, I might be mangling a bit of Hinduism here. So any listeners here, I'd be very glad if you could correct me on this. But there are certain foods which are sattvic, I think the word is, so that they're perfectly fine for everyone to eat, but some of them aren't. Some of them are sort of impure, as it were, for some reason. And garlic and onions fit into that. So garlic gets you a bit sexy.
Of course it does.
You can't be having that. And onions apparently make you, well, not lose your senses, but it sort of changes your behavior and you make bad decisions, apparently, which isn't good.
No.
So they're avoided. Some people just avoid them at times of religious significance, some all the time. So that's why it was really taken up in some groups anyway in India. The Jains, which is a subgroup of Hinduism, have it because, and it's for a completely different reason, I assumed it would just be for the same reason, but it's because that's because they're all vegetarians, vegans, apart from a little bit of dairy. What's very important to them as part of their religion is they cause no harm to animals. And that even includes animals living in or on the soil. So they don't eat any vegetables that have to be dug or pulled up. So they don't eat potatoes either.
Okay.
Because it might cause harm to some of the animals. If I'm right in remembering, I remember hearing this in a documentary a while ago, so I might be misremembering, but I think a lot of people of that faith keep a broom next to their bed so that when they wake up, they can sweep their way out of their room and sweep away any insects or anything that might be crawling on the floor so they don't accidentally tread on them.
Wow.
It's a very important part of their daily life. That's something they're always very mindful of.
No, me neither. And so you mentioned that in your case, it's beneficial to you because of the lack of onion, you can use asafoetida instead. How much would you use, for example, for like a typical dish, you know, for two people? I don't know. Like how is it less than an onion? Is it more?
Well, if you were replacing it, well, first of all, if you can eat onions, just eat onions.
Yeah.
But no, I don't put more than a quarter of a teaspoon in, because the thing is that it's reminiscent of the aroma and taste of onions. It's not the same. So if you put too much in, you're getting the other flavours too. So it's just a suspicion.
It's just like a shadow of an onion.
A suspicion of an onion. Yeah, exactly.
I love that. A suspicion of an onion. Okay. Yeah. Brilliant.
But it does work. It does work. So if anybody there asks, it's very common, you know, I couldn't believe how common it was once I found out. And they're thinking, even though very few people are allergic to onions, but a lot of people are intolerant, and it's being considered to be added, you know, to the list of allergies.
Oh my goodness. Can you imagine what a pain that would be for the catering industry? Because you say everything has onions. Well, a lot of savory dishes have onions or garlic in.
Mm. I mean, again, we could maybe save this for a different letter, but I'm intolerant to quite a few things.
Mm.
Onions, tomatoes.
Yes.
So I'm real good fun if I'm round your house for a dinner party. Cocoa solids. Red wine.
Yeah.
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 So I can't have any of those. I mean, I don't. I'm not going to.
You're okay with aubergine, for example?
Oh, no. So
anything from the night. Because if you can't have tomato, I'm thinking nightshade family is not.
That's true. So I usually don't list aubergine because we don't eat it that often.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't do aubergine either. So if you were to give me a moussaka or something. You wanted to finish me off.
Or a parmigiana, you know, with tomato.
Yeah, yeah.
Moussaka and a big pint of chocolate milkshake.
Lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be.
And just
a bit of
a few aniseed balls just for added entertainment at the end.
That might help.
Yeah, it might do.
It might help. It might be the one thing that saves me.
Apparently, I read that wolves love asafoetida. Wolves. Yeah, quite random. But yeah, we've had dogs with aniseed balls, wolves. There were other animals as well, but it was the wolves that really stood out, I think. Perhaps because of the dogs.
How funny, I didn't come across that one.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre fact. I liked in your recording, I liked the bit you were talking about the wandering womb and how it womb stick.
Sure. The wandering womb. Yeah, it's very popular theory in ancient Greece that the womb literally moved around the body, causing havoc.
Indeed, yeah. And do you think, because you said it in Roman times, it was also used as asafoetida, and they bought into this whole wandering womb philosophy, didn't they?
Well, they certainly adopted a lot of things, didn't they? Repurposed a lot of stuff from ancient Greece, like their gods and what have you. They just gave them a rebranding.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Update them, like Marathon to Snickers. No, I don't know. I think the reason people liked it was because it was similar to Silphium, the long extinct herb.
I think we don't really know what that tastes like, do we? Because
no.
It's been extinct, say, for centuries.
Yeah, just piecing it together. But I also quite liked that adulteration cropped up. I quite liked that asafoetida was used as an adulterant for silphium. I thought that's quite nice.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like an unpleasant alternative. As we discussed in the last episode, there's degrees of adulteration, isn't there?
Mm. Yes,
some
indeed.
Stuff is more acceptable than others.
Yes, and what I don't know is whether it's been adulterated because there wasn't enough of the silphium to go round, or whether they were putting it in sneakily, you know, to make it go further from the point of view of making more profits and hoodwinking people. It wasn't very clear, at least what I read, the reason why they were adulterating it. But it seems to me it's because it was expensive and there wasn't very much of it.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's usually the reason, isn't it? To make something expensive go a bit further and, as you say, hoodwink the customers.
Yeah, yeah.
Thinking they're getting something that they're not.
Indeed.
I was just thinking it's so unusual to find the name of a food that contains within it an adjective that negatively denotes something about it. So, you know, the fact that it's fetid, asafoetida, you know, you don't have that with, though garlic might be a strong smelling and give you kind of the effects you don't have garlic's stinky something, you know, you wouldn't use a word that negatively defines it within that's unusual.
What's that fruit?
Durian,
that's it. These things, and you're not allowed to get on public transport with one and all that kind of stuff.
I didn't know that
doesn't have a name that reflects the fact it's stinky.
I wonder came from, like the origin of that, to say, you know, something that's quite unusual, you know, I don't know.
But
disgusting,
I think
onion. You know, you wouldn't say that, even if it's disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a word that comes in later because hing was the word, and hing was the word used in England for it. So when it first came over, that's why I knew it'd come from India, from the East Indies, probably the East India Company, rather than through the spice routes.
Yes, yeah,
cool. It retained its Indian name.
So who gave it the other name then? Was it someone describing it that was not from culturally, not part of, and was describing it in a way that could be considered pejorative?
I think, well, not pejorative necessarily. I think it was just they were trying to think of a name. Because it's in the Latin name for it. So I think it comes from that. It's got a weird mix of languages. So I think the asapar, which means resin, is Persian. And the fetida is Latin. So that suggests it's something that's been created.
I'm just mesmerized by these things. These are the things that I love. I really love these things because I just don't understand. I mean, it might be a singular thing. Maybe there are other words that are similar to that that have that kind of connotation of something sensorial within it that's negative. But I just find that really interesting.
Mm.
I assume it doesn't leave any aroma on the breath like onions and garlic can.
Don't think so. I suppose there's not enough of it. I don't know. Maybe I do go around with really stinky asafoetida breath the day after I've had a nice darling.
Sure, someone would have said something by now.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that, both. That was really interesting. I now feel like I have plenty of things that I can take the next time I have a little bit of a dodgy tummy and certainly to avoid any embarrassing wind action in the future. Mm-hmm. And yeah, actually, I learned loads of stuff. So thanks for that.
I just find it incredible. There's always so much to learn. And I just love researching for every single thing that we do. Hopefully you all won't have any fat flatulence from now on.
Indeed.
No, it's so British, isn't it? Talking about our bowels. We sound like three old octogenarians.
So, Ali, you're in charge next time. What?
I can't wait. So for next time, I was thinking fruits. What do you think about that?
Fruits is good. We've already had apples, of course. So a big one's already gone.
Yes. Yeah, it has. Yeah. You've done the big one. So that you will have to dig deep, I think, to find something interesting.
My job is done. I have no fruit for next time because I already did apples. No, it doesn't work like that. I have thought of a fruit and obviously beginning with A.
Of course.
Well, thank you both for joining me again today. For everyone listening, if you want to find out more information about today's episode, you can find various links in the show notes. And do look at our link tree where you'll find links to all our social media platforms that we use, like Twitter and Instagram. So if you have any information on the topics that we've covered today that we didn't cover and you think we should know, then do let us know. You can email us at aisforapplepod@gmail.com. And I will see you next time.
Cheerio. Bye.
Bye-bye.